there is simply that charging portion of the complaint clearly designated whether it's a crime, whether it's a violation. And this sets forth all the possible variations on that thing. So far as the worry that somebody can take a felony and bust it all the way down to a violation, they have that authority right now. And there are situations where police go out and they make an arrest and their evaluation is it's a felony crime. And it's reviewed by the district attorney and they reduce it down to a violation. They could reduce, or to a misdemeanor, they could reduce it all the way to a violation. They have that discretion to do so now.
To reduce any felony to a violation? What would they call it?
Well, you could charge somebody initially with burglary, for example. Let's say the person broke into a supermarket at night and committed a burglary. And for whatever reasons, they decided to charge only this attempt at criminal mischief in the third degree because he tampered with the person's property. It could be done. It's not likely. It's not likely. There's nothing here that it's going to give the district attorney any greater leeway in the charging decisions. I mean, this doesn't expand.
The attempted criminal mischief 3 only does fit certain circumstances. I mean, any felony in the world can't end up as an attempted criminal mischief 3.
But again, keep in mind what Mr. Van Dyke said previously. This would be, I don't agree with the problem of county by county differing treatment that exists in the state has for years, and it's certainly no problem. District attorney in each county is elected representative of the people, and he or she is making totally outrageous charging decisions that will come up in the next election.
Can I respond to that? At least in the diversion area, there are criteria that are arguable that each prosecutor is following that are laid out in ORS in the Oregon Revised Statutes. You don't have that here. And I don't want to raise the issue 2 years from now in an election campaign when you're dealing with a client that may be sitting in jail for several weeks before they go to court in one county and be convicted of a crime, and another client in another county is going to be released because of no standards and the local whim of the local prosecutor based on whatever standards he or she may have.
Representative Hill?
Yes, sir. Just to offer one more thing. You mentioned that the district attorneys already have the discretion to charge in this manner. But do you think this legislation will have the effect of encouraging district attorneys to do this more often?
Well, not really. I mean, there's some of the presentation to you, I think Mr. Cooper was suggesting that this bill would be subject to possible abuse by district attorneys, and that they could take a case where they just said, well, we really can't prove this beyond a reasonable doubt, so let's make it a violation and hang it in front of the judge unrepresented in court trial. I don't think that's proper criteria, and I don't think that would stand muster, and I think the district attorneys in the state are smart enough to realize it would pass muster. They're going to have some rational basis for deciding whether to charge a violation or whether a crime. They can't simply say, well, this is a weak case, so we'll choose it as a violation, or this is a strong case, and we'll charge a criminal case. I think that's an invalid.
What prevents that? I'm not sure I understand what it's doing.
What prevents it? The knowing that if it gets challenged, it will be any conviction of that sort.
Well, how would the basis for the decision be articulated? Let's assume the basis is relevant for some attack. I don't know whether it would or wouldn't be, but how would I show what the reason of the DA was for making the decision to downgrade to take the action which converts the matter into a violation?
Two things. It's either on the record in court orally. This says that it's an agreement. It's an oral statement to the court. So it'd be on the record orally, or it's in writing filed with the court ahead of time. So there would be a track record as to what the reasons were for the district attorney and treating this as a violation rather than as a crime.
The amendments require a statement of reasons?
No, not a statement of reasons, but that the motion to reduce a misdemeanor to a violation has to be either orally, on the record in court, or in writing.
But that doesn't yield any information about why that decision was made, though, does it?
Well, not necessarily. But, you know, I guess I have to go back to the experience. So the district attorney now is saying, Your Honor, we move to reduce this to a violation. This person fits our criteria of 1, 2, 3, 4. Yeah, it's on record.
Jerry?
Again, Jerry Cooper, I think this bill is now proposed that the district attorney only has to state that he is not seeking a criminal conviction and the court shall reduce it to a violation, no matter what the reason. Or in writing. But all it is advise the court that the district attorney does not seek a criminal conviction. I think that's all that's mandated. And then there's an automatic or mandatory, the court shall amend the complaint, whatever, and they declare it to be a violation. One of the difficult things for district attorneys, of course, is to turn a person down on a case. And when the merchants come in with a shoplifting case, the likelihood is not great of proving the mental intent, usually of intent to deprive, beyond a reasonable doubt, there's no complaint issued. District attorneys under this proposal would be able to issue, declare it to be the violation, and could satisfy the merchants and the people in the community. And the police are in the same situation. In Washington County, when the DUII was an infraction, police did make many times arrests based on probable cause, because they knew that that was the burden of proof to get an ultimate conviction. But if it was a second-time offender or someone who was going to be treated as a misdemeanor, they investigated their cases much more thoroughly and attempted to come in with better proof because they knew they ultimately had to. So I've had experience where the police and the victims do, people who are investigating these offenses will respond as to what is required as to provability. District attorney is hard pressed to deny cases if the chances of proving the case are good.
We're going to need to move on here pretty immediately. I'll take one more question. Representative Hill.
Thank you very much for your indulgence, Mr. Chairman. I guess it would seem to me that there would be tremendous pressure to save, and in order to save money, that the district attorneys would use this procedure. Is that incorrect? Because as I see it, let me just express my concern and be done with it. It seems to me that there's pressure for the district attorneys to use this procedure in order to save money. Consequently, they will be downgrading these charges more, and it would seem, with more and more defendants, and it would seem to be inherently discriminatory against indigent people, because I would suspect those who can afford counsel, regardless of the charge, will have counsel. Because going through this situation, as we've said, a conviction is a conviction. And if you have money, you will be able to hire counsel. And if you're pushing more and more people down, those who cannot afford counsel, it would seem to me, would be in a disadvantageous position.
Well, I agree there are those concerns. And it is true that perhaps district attorneys might be concerned about the money, the resources situation, and try to downgrade them. I disagree with the concept that a conviction is a conviction. I think people understand very clearly the difference between a conviction that carries no possible jail penalty and a conviction where you can go to an employer and say, no, I've never been convicted of a crime, as opposed to a conviction that does carry a jail penalty and very severe sanctions and is known to be a criminal conviction. I think people understand, in my experience in court, explaining that distinction, that people seem to comprehend it pretty clearly.
What about an employer, Judge?
Well,
if that were on your record, I mean, applying for the bar exam, for example.
Yeah. The employer, I can't answer for employers. If it is not a criminal conviction, it's not a criminal conviction. They may not understand that.
But it's on their record. Wouldn't it be on your record?
Well, if you mean a theft, for example, as a theft violation, rather
yes.
than a theft criminal conviction.
Yes.
There would be a computer. Everything we do these days is tracked by computers. So, yeah, there would be a record that it would show as a violation rather than as a criminal conviction.
The charge, though, would be whatever it was originally as a misdemeanor.
Yes.
The description of the misconduct and its legal, its initial legal description, not its classification, but its crime, the nature, its description as a crime would be, that's what appears without change. Which is, I think, the concern that Jerry was going off, or judge, maybe both, as to the commonality of the impact of that, regardless of the fact that it's treated as a violation with respect to employment or whatever the contexts were being mentioned. Thank you all very much. We appreciate it. We will bring the bill back for a work session. I expect that at that point will be purely discussion within the subcommittee. I don't think it's going to be necessary for you all to traipse back here.
We're
to write more briefs. We very much appreciate the time you spent trying to help us understand these issues. Mr. Gallen, are you here? Ah, yes. We adopted the amendments which had been proposed, but left open the issue of the records raised in your letter. Would you please detail a little more on the basis of your concern?
Well, certainly. For the record, my name is Scott Gallant.
We're now back to House Bill, number is that? 2492. Go ahead, Bill.
Scott Gallant with the Oregon Medical Association. I, as the letter indicates, had a conversation with the state medical examiner about the portion of the bill relating to medical records. The long and short of that conversation was that it is extremely rare to need access to a person's medical records. But beyond that, because the phrase is extremely general, there's the potential that people would read in those records things that are extremely personal. As an example, whether someone had a venereal disease or not, one's wife found out, and the person did indeed end up not being missing. It could be a very a traumatic experience for that particular family. The standard, as I understand it, in Oregon regarding the confidentiality of records is that those records are to be released upon the individual's approval. The suggested language in the bill as it is now does not in fact limit it to any areas that might be needed specifically to identify a missing body. I believe you have in your documents a example from California of a reporting form, missing persons reporting form. In about the middle of the page, it lists some types of information that might be used in identification. Body x-rays available, yes, no, broken bones, missing organs, which is about the only portion that I've noticed in quickly glancing at the document that might be important for identifying a missing body. Also, in, again, it's my understanding medical examiners in instances that they have inquired for information that might help identify a missing person. have not had difficulty in discovering, one, whether the person is on a major drug or not, as stated in the letter, which is basically information going from one physician to another physician, and, you know, information being kept relatively limited as to access. Maybe one alternative to the language that is currently in the bill might be to add a section or some language of adopting some regulations that specifically state the type of information that might be available in consultation with the state medical examiner to kind of narrow the gap of what kind of information you're looking for. I have, of course, not seen the proposed amendments. Apologize for not being here earlier.
Would your concern, as I understand it, is that the request could extend to forms of information which are not relevant to?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Contributing to identifying the person, is that right?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
And of course, another example may be psychiatric records. Of course, would be included under medical records, and those, of course, very sensitive documents as well.
Isn't there a way we could narrow that, even apart from imposing some almost rulemaking type of authority or responsibility, simply by our description of the information which is to be provided?
Yes, sir. I think you could.
And if we were to characterize it by some reference to relevant to the such and such.
I think that would take care of the concern, and I'd be more than happy to sit down and try to, look over any language of that type, because it looks like there's really specific information being requested for, this pretty unusual, at least from my knowledge, for a missing arm or a missing organ, Anyway, so yes, I'd be more than happy to.
Well, now that would be relevant, would you not?
Oh, yes,
yes, you're
sure.
You're saying that would, okay.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to move conceptually. Well, let me ask, do you see any reason why we shouldn't attempt in the bill to try to make clear that the information that's to be provided is not to be open-ended in respect to the.
I think that was the intent, Mr. Chairman. People are probably get drafted very well, was to ask for specific information by providing the physician or the, what would they form, but ask for specific information to valuable identifying a person, not to have a police department or walk in and pick up a medical record by the site, that would be totally useless. I think conceptually, I had a chance to talk to Dr. Alexander that he would support. I don't know if it needs to be in the bill, rulemaking. I personally, being in a state agency, have a version of rulemaking. So, but conceptually, I think he stated that it should be intended to state in the bill.
Just scanning the amendments that we previously adopted conceptually and that were presented to us, I see under section 4.1 that there is an attempt under subparagraph 2 to tie the type of available dental, medical, or physical information to that which would assist in identification of the missing person. Now, perhaps legislative counsel can give us more precise or definite language, but it does seem to me that that's the intent of these amendments.
I'm not sure if Mr. Gallant's seen this.
No, I have not.
No,
you know, I think there are two components to this as well. One is where that information goes. Does it go to a medical examiner, or does it go to the family? What is the liability of the release of that type of information to a family or to a third party? in this process.
I appreciate the concern you're expressing. I guess maybe my question is directed to counsel. It seems to me that already there exists in law a means whereby members of a family or a person presumably with some immediate need or interest can already obtain some medical records of an individual. Presumably the person is unable to provide informed consent for a medical procedure. The next of kin or some member of the family or guardian or someone in a guardian-like role would obviously have a need and would be able to obtain those medical records without the actual consent of the person involved. And I'm not sure if that's spelled out in statute or a rule somewhere. Seems to me that procedure exists already. Where there's some concern that overrides, you know, what we obviously see as an even privilege. I guess aside from that, it seems like common practice, for better or for worse, that people maybe without realizing that whenever if they have an automobile accident or if they make a claim for medical insurance, they're signing a waiver that just more or less opens up every medical record they've got anyway to the request of some person that's in a reimbursement or responsibility.
Representative Spring, as you'll recall, on a few occasions, the OMA has brought in legislation involving confidentiality of records. It's a very difficult area to deal with. As I understand the law currently, in most cases, confidential medical records are not accessible, except in cases where someone is mentally incompetent. But I believe the access to those records would most often be a summary of the entire medical record, unless there was a need otherwise. Secondly, most often, as I understand the standard practice, physicians will transfer records from one physician to another physician rather than having even the individual carry those records from one point to another. One of the arguments for that is that there are times in personal medical records that comments are made about illnesses or things or the psychological situation of the individual that might be harmful even to the patient himself, at least from reading it and saying, well, you know, he thought I was, you know, whatever, you know, while someone's trying to make a diagnosis of a disease. But yes, there are some exceptions. But even for x-rays, most often those are transferred from one specialist or one physician to another physician, because quite often they are not really usable by anyone else. That's my understanding.
Thank you.
Well, I'm going to move that Section 6 sub 1 be conceptually moved, that it be amended to clarify in concert with 4 sub 2 that the information is information which would assist in identification of the missing person. Entire amendments are going to legislative council, so that'll be worked in for the consideration, final review by the full committee if the bill is otherwise clear today. Is there any objection to that amendment?
I have not read through all these amendments, but is it clear and is it the intent that any medical record information that there is a request for goes just to the law enforcement agency and for only their eyes, or can that be handled? As I'm reading it really quickly, it sounds like that they shall furnish the information on forms to be provided by the requesting person, and the information is restricted to use for purposes of the act. Is it the intent that that information only then goes to the law enforcement agency to plug into the system as opposed to being available to the family?
I that it may be a decision that the legislature should make as to whether in these cases the family should have a burden of producing information entering the system under the guidelines that the FBI is putting out to their agents, and then they will be involved. That's the approach they're taking. It doesn't mean we're going to take that approach. I think, looking at it from my law enforcement background, if I were taking such a report, I'd prefer to get the permission from the family and try to find out where to get the information and make sure it was done. It was the intent to be used only for that purpose, and the person subsequently located, there's a provision requiring to seal, maybe that could be sealed or destroyed, but you're never sure about methods of destruction, maybe throwing it in the trash can. So we get that provision for sealing, because obviously anyone else needs that record for the initial go back to the source for whatever legitimate purpose they need for getting it secondhand.
Under this, you raised a question in my mind. Under this, let's say I skip out of town for a couple days and I'm trying to get away from my spouse and I'm hiding out somewhere, and they've done this search and they end up getting my dental and medical reports and all these. I guess it does raise a question in my mind then. Do these, am I then forever described in these records on this law, this missing persons computer system, my dental and medical and whatever other records?
No, it would be incumbent upon the agency that issued, that entered the record. Upon you're being located, you're no longer a missing person, cancel that record. And that's no guarantee that they will do it. The only thing I can tell you is that every 6 months we print out from the system a list of records that agencies have in, send it out to them, and require them to validate that. And should they discover a record hasn't been taken out, they should have been, it's their obligation to take it out.
So it disappears altogether from the system?
Yes. Normally, if you were in the system, the way it would work, if you were put in the system by the Salem Police Department, subsequently found to be in Provo, Utah, they would enter what is called a locate against that record. And NCIC would immediately send the Salem Police Department a notice that says, when this recruitment has been found, take your record out. And if they don't take it out, NCIC will take it out, and we will take it out.
Further questions, Little?
No, I'm sorry.
Further questions from the committee or subcommittee?
Mr. Chairman, comments?
Yeah.
I'm Timothy Alexander. I appeared before you before today. I'd like to say that I agree wholeheartedly with what Mr. Allen was saying. And I don't think the intent was ever to just get a wholesale record of everything about the person. Perhaps in Section 6, information relating to we could reword that to say information pertinent to the identification of the patient.
Yes, we my motion earlier was intended to approve that kind of change in concept, and we'll work out that language and give you a chance to look at it before the bill is dealt with by the full committee.
Mr. Allen referred to a form from California, and you don't have it in your hands. Just became available this afternoon, and it does list specific things. It doesn't ask for a blanket record. Thank you.
Thank you, Doctor.
I'll leave my copy of the form with you and ask our counsel to try to think of some appropriate language as well. Try to match it up. What does that mean?
The chair would move that House Bill 2492, as amended, be reported to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. That's with the understanding that the amendments will be reviewed for form and style and any issues of clarification by council and committee council, legislative council, and any such refinements will take up at the full committee, presumably without undue difficulty as to time. I'd rather send it on if the subcommittee is otherwise amenable to the law improvements recommended. Is there further discussion? Call the roll.
Hill?
Aye.
Lawbar?
Aye.
Miller?
Aye.
Springer?
Aye.
Meyer?
Aye.
We've got a problem. We're up against caucus meetings that involve the members of both caucuses on the subcommittee, and we have members, people from the public and others who've been